Today's talk is given by Andy Whiteman, author and researcher on land and community rights issues. His talk is entitled, The Poor Had No Lawyers, Who Owned Scotland, and How They Got It. Andy's recent book of the same name has been described by the Sunday Herald as utterly magnificent, also gaining praise from, amongst others, the Edinburgh Law Review and the Times Literary Supplement. Andy originally studied forestry at the University of Aberdeen and has worked as a Stockers Gillie, environmental scientist and environmental campaigner before becoming self-employed in the early 90s. He has been described as one of the foremost architects of the land reform movement of the 1990s and is a regular expert commentator on the current hot topic of common good land. We therefore look forward to an engaging and highly topical seminar. So without further ado, I present Andy Whiteman.
Thanks very much, Rowan. Well, delighted to be here and see so many folk here. What time can everybody hear me at the back? Yeah?
Yeah.
Good. What I want to do is just talk through some of the main themes of the book I wrote last year, which is to do with the kind of history of land in Scotland and how it became appropriated by private interests. I then want to talk a little bit about a couple of sort of stories around that, contemporary stories, before finishing by talking about issues to do with land information. And governance. So I thought I'd just start by saying something about the cover of my book, which is this rather nice photograph, which turns out to be taken by an amateur photographer who's the head of history at Huntley Academy. And so I contacted him and asked him where this was taken, and he told me it was a farm called Ardoch, a settlement called Ardoch in Upland Aberdeenshire. And that kind of rang a bell with me, and I realised why it rang a bell with me, because my wife's great-great-great-grandfather's brother was a parish priest here in Ardoch. This may very well have been his house. But it's the only house left in what was a township of about 20 houses, with a shop and a school. And there's only this house left. And it's quite interesting, because this picture really is an allegory for what I have to say in the book. And the reason it's lying derelict today, nobody lives here anymore, is all to do with the fact that in 1886, the Crofting Reform Act, which was passed to give security of tenure to peasant farmers in the Highlands, didn't extend to Aberdeenshire. The big lowland landowners did not want crofting tenure to extend to any further than it need, and they opposed the extension of crofting tenure to Aberdeenshire and Perthshire and the lowlands in the House of Lords. For no better reason than that the Napier Commission, which was set up to look into the condition of crofters and cotters, having visited Aberdeenshire, they said they would restrict the Crofting Act to the counties that the Napier Commission had visited. So you find a lot of settlements like this in Upland, Aberdeenshire, and Murrayshire and Bampshire, and places are completely deserted and people gone. And even today, people here are living on a year-to-year tenancy. The title's taken from a book of essays by a professor of constitutional law at this university, Cosmo Innes, who was a principal clerk at the Court of Session. He was also an antiquarian, and together with Thomas Thomson, he compiled the definitive account of Scotland's laws up to the Union in 1707. He was born in Aberdeenshire in an estate called Durris. His father was had been the sheriff of Murrayshire, quite well to do. He took a 99-year lease on Durris in Aberdeenshire on the South Dee side. And he became a victim of a House of Lords ruling on the law of entail, which I won't go into. Basically, the law of entail was a law that protected landowners in the event that they went bankrupt. Their assets were protected from seizure. So a lot of landowners who might otherwise have gone bankrupt, their estates would have been split up, sold off, were protected by the fact that they were entailed. And this went right up from 1905. And the strict application of the law of entail meant that nobody could lease or sell any of an entailed estate. Now, the Duke of Gordon's father had actually leased this to Cosmo Innes's father, and the young Duke of Gordon complained to the court that this wasn't legitimate. The court upheld that, and so Cosmo Innes's family were evicted. He moved to Edinburgh and became a famous lawyer, and he wrote a book called Lectures on Scotch Legal Antiquities, which was a series of essays he gave to students, lectures he gave to students, and one of which laments the fact that when the common lands of Scotland were divided, the nobility got got the lot and the poor got none because the poor had no lawyers. So that's just a little bit about the... and just to remind ourselves as well, when we're talking about the land of Scotland, we're talking about land and territory right out to the 200-mile continental shelf limit, Scotland's territorial seas. So most of Scotland, in fact, is underwater. Of course, all this blue stuff is all the subject of a heated debate about the future of the Crown Estate and who administers the Crown Estate. It's currently administered by a body called the Crown Estate Commissioners, and there are some provisions in the Scotland Bill that are being debated in the House of Lords just now to appoint a Scottish Crown Estate Commissioner, and the House of Lords have decided to amend that, and instead of calling it a Scottish Crown Estate Commissioner, it'll be called a Crown Estate Commissioner for Scotland. So that's some of the debate in the House of Lords about it just now. But it's a very active debate with the Scottish Government wanting to repatriate control over the Crown Estate. We can talk a little bit more about that, if you like. I just thought I'd start by reminding ourselves that land is not just about kind of rural, remote places, which a lot of people think of when they hear the term land or land reform. This is the headquarters of the Bank of Ireland on the banks of the Liffey in Dublin. And it's, as far as I know, it's still like this in an unfinished state because, of course, Bank of Ireland went down the Swanee with the Irish economy, which was built on a vast Ponzi scheme. Of never-ending speculation on land prices. And it's interesting because in 2006, our dear Chancellor, George Osborne, went to Dublin and he wrote in the Times that a generation ago, the very idea that a British politician would go to Ireland to see how to run an economy would have been laughable. The Irish were Britain's poor and troubled country cousin. Today, things are different. Ireland stands as a shining example of the art of the possible in long-term economic policy-making. That's why we've done it, to listen and to learn. So if I say nothing else, it would be to say that land is at the root of a lot of our economic woes in the West and across the world. And the fact that George Osborne thinks that Ireland was a shining example of long-term economic policy making tells us everything we need to know about the fact that land isn't treated seriously in the economy. 2010, Financial Times, at the height of the lunacy, around three-quarters of the lending of Irish banks, $420 billion, two and a half times the size of the economy, got bound up in property construction and land speculation, a sort of northern rock on steroids. And of course the whole pack of cards came tumbling down. So land is vital. If you don't manage land right, you can literally bankrupt your country and you can have a generation of people with no opportunities. Also, land is important in terms of how we tax it. I've been recently doing some investigations in Glasgow. There was a big fire in Glasgow at the end of November, and I'm a rather sad individual, but when big events like that happen, it was a huge fire. There were like 100 fire engines and everything. The first question I ask is, who owns this building on fire? So I found out who owned it. It was owned by a company called Strabane Developments Limited in Belfast. And what's interesting about the fire is it's an old co-op building, a beautiful building, a listed building, which they bought in 2003 as a speculative purchase, never did anything with. And when it went on fire, of course, they expected the Clyde Fire and Rescue to put the fire out, as indeed, of course, they should. But the point about this is that this is an industrial building that's vacant, and so they're exempt from business rates. It's valued at £300,000, its rateable value, so... Were they not to be exempt, they would be paying somewhere in the region of £140,000 a year in business rates. In other words, over the 5 years, six, 7 years in fact, they've owned it, they would have paid in excess of £500,000. So they're paying no local taxes whatsoever, and yet they expect the fire brigade to come out and put out the fire in their building. The fire brigade, incidentally, I asked Strathclyde Fire and Rescue how much they pay in business rates over Strathclyde, and they paid last year £2.5 million business rates themselves for all the fire stations. So it's a question of who pays rates and who doesn't pay. The fact that all agriculture and forestry land is exempt from business rates, which is kind of strange because a lot of landowners claim that they're thriving businesses. And when you ask them why they don't pay business rates like everybody else, they get all coy. Of course, it hits home really in the housing market, which was the root of Ireland's woes. And we never learn. This is November 2010, Herald newspaper. Edinburgh house prices reached new record levels, to which I think, well, what record? Record low, record high. And inside, of course, you get the full story. Sorry, another slide. But it's talking about the house prices bouncing back. In other words, we're back on the roller coaster. So we never learn. And it's interesting, if you look at the index of housing market costs since 1983 up till 2007, it's very interesting that building costs, that's the bottom line, haven't changed. It cost just as much to build a house in 2007 as it did in 1983. Earnings have barely changed. House prices have gone through a couple of the spikes. A big change has been land prices. And that's why houses are expensive. You can go onto the internet to a company called Hebridean Homes, for example, who design buildings designed to Danish and Norwegian building standards, and they'll supply a two-bedroom house for £38,000. Most young people in rural areas in particular could afford £38,000. They could borrow most of that. What they can't afford is £80,000 to pay for a plot of land. And this is a big social issue as well, because a big debate just now about benefit caps. So for most of us, you'll have a house if you're lucky. If you're in benefits, you're going to get a £400 a week, rent cap. And there'll be a total cap of £26,000 in benefits. And you probably won't have a car, almost certainly won't have a car. So this is the law, the welfare reform bill that's being devised, to cap the amount of public money that the poorest in society receive. The other end of the scale, people like Mr. Stephen Strathdee, who owns 39 farms in Murrayshire and Aberdeenshire, earned £3 million in land sales over the last 10 years, received £3.5 million in public subsidies and agricultural grants. There's no cap for him, and he rides a Bentley GT convertible. So if you own land, you're in the money, and if you don't, you're not. So land matters. One of the first people I read on this topic was Scotland's Secretary of State for Scotland in the War, Tom Johnson, Second World War, author of a great book called Our Scots Noble Families, and also author of a book called The History of the Working Classes in Scotland, in which there's a chapter called The Reaving of the Common Lands, which was my first exposure to the theft of Scotland's commons. And in that, he argues that we shall be rather under than overestimating the common acreage in the latter part of the 16th century, at fully one half of the entire area of Scotland. In other words, 500 years ago, half of Scotland was held in common. So the current fad about community ownership, for example, is nothing new. It's very, very old. Indeed, it's private ownership that is the novel thing in land markets. So how did we get to this impasse? Well, I recount six land grabs. The first was the imposition of feudalism. And this is the title of one of my chapters from a book, Robert the Bruce, A Murdering Medieval Warlord. Some of my nationalist friends tell me that they like the book, but they think I've given Bruce a rather hard time. And to which I respond, well, what of murdering medieval and warlord? Do you disagree? And of course, people like Bruce, he didn't fight because he wanted Scotland to be independent. He fought because he wanted the crown. I mean, he fought for a prize. He had big lands in England. He had he'd sworn an oath of loyalty to the King of England, to Edward. The nobility at that time had interests right across the British Isles and France, and Flanders and places. So Robert the Bruce saw the opportunity to seize the crown of Scotland and took it, and fair play to him. That's what he did if you were a medieval warlord. And on the way there, of course, he murdered someone, the Red Comyn in Dumfries Abbey, to get his way. And, of course, the significance of the prize, winning the crown of Scotland, was you literally owned the whole country. The crown owned the whole country. And so you were then able to grant out feudal charters to your friends and supporters, and you could revoke these charters at any time. So you had immense power. And, of course, feudalism replaced previous forms of indigenous tenure, about which we know very little. But that was the first major land grab, and it meant that by 1400, Scotland was really parcelled up into parishes and lordships and earldoms at that early stage. The second land grab was in the 16th century, leading up to the Reformation, when the church, which was very wealthy in Scotland, it had an annual income of around £360,000 a year. The crown had an annual income of about £17,000. Places like Crossraigle Abbey and Dumfries in Ayrshire, the church owned most of Ayrshire. And this was the scene of a fairly grisly episode when the Earl of Castles, who was a big noble in Ayrshire, wanted to get his hands on the lands of the church. And the way that nobility tended to do this was they got their sons or nephews in as what were called commendators. These were the chief executives of the abbey. They handled all the money and things. So if you could get someone friendly into that position, you could start getting life rents and charters and things from the church. So this particular commendator, he wanted his nephew in as and didn't get it. And there was a young chap called Alan Stewart was appointed. And the Earl of Castles kidnapped Alan Stewart and took him to his castle at Dunure and slowly roasted him over a spit for a week and asked him to hand over the charters of the church lands, which he did eventually. And then he was imprisoned in the dungeon and an enemy of the Earl of Castles came and rescued him. And he went off to the Market Cross in Ayr and denounced the Earl of Castles. There was a Privy Council inquiry and the Earl of Castles was fined £2,000. So that's kind of the extreme end of what was going on in the 16th century. The third land grab was really when the lawyers got involved, and this was very significant. In the 17th century, the last time, in fact, we had a Scottish Parliament, it spent most of its time devising ways of securing land rights for the nobility and devising new ways of killing Highlanders. And this is when the lawyers really got involved. So in 1617, for example, Parliament sat, and they passed the Registration Act. And the Registration Act set up the Register of Saisons, which is in existence today. Those of you who live in Scotland and own property will probably have your property on the Register of Saisons. This was basically a register set up, one of the earliest land registers in the world. And basically all you had to do was to record a deed in the Register of Saisons. And that made it public, in theory. And the next act that was passed was the Act of Prescription, which meant that as long as you held that land for at least 40 years, it would be exempt from challenge. So if there had been some dodgy dealings in the past, you could show you had a recorded title, and you could show that you'd possessed it for 40 years, your land would be exempt from challenge. And that really buttressed a lot of the land theft that had taken place in the 16th century with the lands from the church. And the lawyers were seriously involved. They passed the laws of entail, for example, which I mentioned, all of which buttressed land and power. The fourth land grab was when the nobility turned their attention to the vast areas of land still held in common in Scotland's parishes, the parish commons or commonties. These were areas of land that had never been feudalised, dated from pre-feudal times, and were lands that were held in common for the use of the parishioners. The fifth land grab was when all those lands had been divided, or nearly all of them, and the laws that allowed for their division exempted lands held by Scotland's royal boroughs. So the next act of appropriation was Scotland's royal boroughs, where there was a lot of land held in common by the borough. A lot of this land had been given by earlier kings and queens who'd granted the royal boroughs their charters. And in fact, in 1491, there was an act which emphasised that the common land of the borough, the common good, was held for the common good of the town, and that the funds should be used for the common and necessary things for the borough by the advice of the town council. And this had to be passed because there was beginning to creep in corruption. And so they needed to pass an act to remind the magistrates that the town council's funds were for the common good of the people. However, and these lands are quite extensive in places like Irvine, the yellow here, the borough lands of Irvine in 1820, quite extensive areas of land held in the common good. And today, these common lands are celebrated in places like the Borders and Hoyk and Melrose and Selkirk and places where they have common riding festivals in the summertime, at weekend, when people ride around on horseback. And this is an old tradition. It was a necessary thing to do. You needed to ride around the marches of the town lands in order to be able to spot any encroachment, because of course the Duke of Buccleuch and Roxburgh were very keen to nibble away at the edges of these royal boroughs, because the land was very valuable. Remember, if you owned land in a royal borough, you were a vassal of the crown and you therefore got a vote before the 19th century reform acts. And in places like Aberdeen, Robert the Bruce in fact gave a big charter to Aberdeen. Land 14 miles in circumference around Aberdeen were given to the people of Aberdeen. This is one of the boundary stones of the former lands. But all of this land was alienated over the following 400 years through nepotism and corruption. And it really started because in 1469 there had been a lot of commotion. People were rioting in the streets because the councillors were not holding elections as they should do every year. So an act was passed in 1469 that said because of the great disturbance and contention each year for the choosing of the council through the multitude and clamour of the common simple persons, that's you and me, it's not expedient that the council shall not be continued according to the King's Law of Boroughs. In other words, instead of saying we should have elections every year and they must be held, they thought let's dispense with elections, and they chose the new town council in a new manner. That's to say, the old town council should choose the new one, and together they'll choose all the officers. So this is what happened in 1469 and borough reform in 1833. The old council chose the new council. So it was rampant corruption and nepotism. And I documented this in the book. There were several parliamentary inquiries into the corruption that took place. But as a consequence of that corruption, a lot of common land disappeared in the boroughs. Places like St Andrews, for example, the famous golf links in St Andrews, which were common land of the people of St Andrews, and they played golf. The town went bankrupt as a consequence of their corruption. And the golf links were all leased to a Charlie Dempster, who was a rabbit farmer. And the rabbits did quite a bit of damage to the golf course, making new holes and bunkers and things. And the townsfolk were displeased, and there were wars. There were commentary wars. People came out with weapons and fought. And eventually a local landowner gave money to the town council to buy out Mr. Dempster, and they got it back. And of course they today are the famous golf links in St Andrews. So these lands matter to people. In Edinburgh, the Common Good Fund was used indeed to acquire the land on which the new town was constructed. This is the first two acquisitions of land in yellow, of land from Heriot's Hospital, that is now the new town. The sixth land grab, of course, is when we ran out of land here and went abroad and stole other people's land. That was interesting because Britain's last act of colonial acquisition actually took place in 1955, and I'm indebted to Dr. Fraser MacDonald here, who's done a lot of studying into the history of this. We were concerned, I say we, Britain was concerned, that this was the Cold War, after the Second World War, the Cold War, and we were testing rockets in South Uist, and we were concerned that Rockall would be occupied and taken by the Soviets. So we decided to annex it. And the Admiralty was charged with going to annex and colonise Rockall. The only problem was they didn't know how to do it, because it had been a long time since we'd colonised anywhere. So they asked the Colonial Office, which still existed then, how do you colonise? And they said, well, it's really very simple. And they referred to the charters that had been given, the warrant that had been given to Captain Cook and all the rest of it. And they just drafted a royal warrant signed by the Queen and said, you know, sail forth, take this land, seize it in my name. So they got a ship and HMS Vidal, and they sailed, and it was too stormy to land on the day. And they sailed past and fired a 21-gun salute, and they affixed a plaque. And this is basically the essence of the royal warrant by authority of a Queen Elizabeth II, by the grace of God, lands, territories, commonwealth, faith, etc. In accordance with Her Majesty's instructions, the landing was effected. The Union flag was hoisted in possession of the island, taking the name of Her Majesty. And that's how you do it. That's how we've always done it. And, of course, things came to a head, though, because, of course, this is how we did things in the New World when we colonised lands. But in Australia, of course, the people who were there when we arrived were not really happy about this. And this chap on the left is Eddie Mavo. And he was a Torres Strait Islander. He lived in a little island off the north of Queensland. And Queensland was seizing his land for, I can't remember what reason, but he opposed it and took him to court. And eventually won in the Supreme Court of Australia. There were Mabo versus Queensland, ruled that there were people in Australia before Captain Cook arrived. This was news to the legal establishment, and said that there was no such thing as terra nullius, and that Eddie Mabo had land rights, and so Eddie Mabo got his land back. So this is a profound ruling that turned in its head 200 years of colonial fiction. So, a couple of things going on today to illustrate this in Scotland. One is a common or an Aelith in eastern Perthshire, and this was a hill which is held in common. In 1922, however, the Earl of Airlie, who owned the farms around about, decided to sell these farms to their sitting tenants, which is fair enough. But he also decided to parcel up the common and sell that to them as well, which of course he had no right to do. But nevertheless, the local folk didn't know this had happened. And it was really only after the Second World War, when we started getting grants to farmers, they started putting up fences, that people became aware that their common had been stolen. And they actually went up, had a big series of marches and demonstrations on the hill, and the town councillors actually went up and they cut the fences, and were arrested by the local constabulary, and they were released without charge. And this was people seeking to protect their land rights. And it was interesting because one of the title deeds for the land actually states blatantly at the bottom here, this is the Earl of Airlie's trustees, and states that we as trustees have never claimed this land as part of our or their trustees' property, but nevertheless it can be construed from the titles that the said subjects may be included therein. In other words, this isn't ours, we know it's not, but you can make a case that it is, so here it's here. And this goes back to the old Register of Seasons. You record a title, you sit in it for now 10 years, and it's yours. The legitimisation of land theft. Big disputes around 2000 about the Kulin Mountains in Skye. These were put on the market by Chief John MacLeod, who had a leaky castle, needed to raise money to mend his roof. And there was a great fuss. MacLeod's title dates from 1611. This is it here. Fortalicio Maneri Loco Melendez Pastoris Toftis Crostis Partibus Pendiculus, etc. 20 pages of this stuff. And he was basically claiming that he owned the Kulin Mountains, and to cut a long story short, he probably was never given the Kulin Mountains, but merely appropriated them in subsequent centuries. Another case I'm working on just now, this is a small area of common land in Yell here in Lanarkshire, I discovered. The people in the parish don't know it exists. Well, they didn't then, they do now. Particularly significant because at the time it was in the middle of what was Britain's, Europe's largest onshore wind farm, the Blacklaw Wind Farm. And you can see here the turbines and the servicing and cables and things, and they go right around the common. So I phoned up Scottish Power and asked them why they didn't put a turbine on the common. And they said they didn't know who would sign the lease. And I said, well, that is an interesting question. But they said they just left it aside. And of course, the local people didn't know they owned this, and therefore they couldn't get in on the act. They do now. And this is it here. This is a little piece of common land, and these are the turbines surrounding it. So we're working to try and establish a legal title to this, which is not very easy, given the way that Scots property law works. And there's no system of registering commons, unlike in England, where you can just do it with your local authority. Scottish Power wants you to extend this, so there's a chance of getting a turbine there on behalf of the community. Moving on, going back to what I was talking about earlier, one of the big issues with land, of course, is its inflated values. This is some land for sale near Spean Bridge in Lochaber, rural land, just heather, worth about £100 an acre. Gets planning consent, then it's worth £60,000 an acre. This all came to a head, really, in London. There was a big study done because we built an extension to the Jubilee line out to Canary Wharf, which cost us £3.5 billion in taxpayers' money. And there was a property developer who owned a lot of land, and he went around and assessed the value of this land and came to the conclusion that land values within 500 metres of each station, the underground station, had risen by between 9.75 and 13.5 billion. In other words, we spent £3.5 billion of hard-earned taxpayers' cash, built a railway line, and landowners pocketed £10, £11, £12 billion. And that's at the root of our economic woes, the fact that we borrow money to speculate on land, to buy consumer goods and go shopping. People like the Germans, they don't speculate on land and property, they mainly live in houses that they rent for 20, 30 years, they don't use credit cards by and large, and they invest all their savings in German industry and make things that people want to buy. Yeah, it's interesting because Monopoly, actually, the game, arose from a game called the Landlord's Game, which was devised in the US, which was designed to illustrate the iniquities of monopoly ownership of land. And there are actually two rules for the Landlord's Game, and people used to play as a parlor game in houses in upstate New York and Vermont and places. And there's two rules. One was the rules we kind of understand now, where you play for 6 hours, six people play, one person wins and everyone else is left bankrupt and depressed. But there's also another set of rules where people paid what was then called the single tax, where landowners paid the rental value of the land they occupied and therefore could not speculate and could not gain merely from the possession of that land. They had to improve it. So when they built hotels or houses, as you do in Monopoly, they could charge rent for that, but they couldn't charge it for the land itself. And that game, when you played that game, it went on forever. It never ended. Nobody won. Nobody lost. It became very boring. But that's why. But it wasn't very exciting. It wasn't going to sell. So they decided to impose the Monopoly rules, and that became the successful. I just want to finish off by talking about two things. I mean, firstly, it's to do with governance of land. And I feel quite strongly about this. We have a very, very, very centralised system of governance in Scotland. It's interesting if you compare Scotland with the continent of Europe, the French communes or Spanish municipios, where you have a level of democracy that's very, very local, and people know exactly what's happening, and local municipalities hold the cadastral maps, the registers of local ownership, and everybody knows who owns what, and everything's quite transparent, and everyone knows what's going on. And if you look at our local governance in comparison to a number of European countries, you see that we have the lowest number of municipalities, 32, with a median population of over 100,000, covering around 1,000 square kilometres. Compared to France, for example, which has got a ridiculous number of municipalities. But anyway, the median population of 380. I think the smallest one is a population of 89, which is really a bit silly. But then if you take Scotland's parishes, which are traditionally the kind of unit of governance of most countries and the basis of European local government, and you plug that in, you see that we come kind of eeksy-peeksy. That's where we, in my view, should be. And it's the fact that we've lost, well, we lost our parish councils in 1929, we lost 200 town councils in 1975, we've lost this kind of knowledge and awareness about what's going on with land, but all sorts of other issues to do with planning and environmental health, etc. We've lost this, and it's become centralised in vast, remote bureaucracies. Just to finish off on land information, of course, for years and years, people have wanted to know more about who owns land, but it was always regarded as a great taboo subject, because, of course, Britain has Scotland in particular, a very, very concentrated pattern of land ownership, which is a reflection in part on things like our law of inheritance. Children still don't have any legal rights to inherit land, unlike France and Germany and places where they do, and that's meant that land's been held in very, very large parcels. But there was a lot of agitation in the late 19th century, and the government actually eventually initiated a survey of land in Britain and Ireland and published a report on the owners of lands and heritages in 1872. And they published county by county throughout the British Isles an account of everybody who owned land, more than an acre of land. And that was done in the space of 3 years. They managed to do that in 1870. Two. No maps, just lists. And in 1910, our friend Lloyd George and Churchill, his Chancellor, who was still a Liberal at that time, passed the famous People's Budget. And this contained proposals to tax land, because Lloyd George hated landlords. He hated them so much. He passed the Finance Act, which taxed land. Not because he wanted to get money off them, actually, but because he knew if he taxed land, the Inland Revenue would have to find out who owned the whole of the country, and that's what he really was after. And so in 1910, they passed the Finance Act, and the Inland Revenue immediately began mapping, again, the whole of Britain and Ireland, every house, every property in the big towns and cities and the countryside. And this is one of the maps they produced, 1910, the Inland Revenue Survey. This is an area of rural land outside Blairgowrie. But they managed to map 99.2% of Britain and Ireland with pen and paper in 1910. It was a remarkable achievement. Today, we've got a land register that's replaced the Register of Saisines. This is the coverage today. 20% of Scotland's landmass is on the land register. And it means that I run a website called Who Owns Scotland, because we have a demand for information for land which is not adequately met by the public agencies, and which people want to know. They want to know who owns it, where they can contact these people, what their address is, etc. I was asked to say something about my run-ins with the Ordnance Survey, but we can say that in questions and answers. I mean, if you notice it closely, I'm using 1924 maps on this website, because the Ordnance Survey demanded £15,000 a year from me. Having said that everything was hunky-dory for 5 years, they then changed their mind and told me I was in breach of licence and all the rest of it. So, big problems in using data as well. But land registration now is, there's a bill before Parliament to update the land registration in Scotland, which is quite significant. And some of the problems that this has arisen, given rise to, illustrated by our friend Mr. Trump here, who, this is a house on Mr. Trump's estate. He doesn't own this house. But he sent the occupier, the owner of this house, a letter saying that he'd built his garage on his land and he was to remove it within 72 hours or he would take court action. And he had a point, because the fence was here. This is where the fence was. And that's not this chap's boundary, the chap's boundary here. But that was fine, he always knew that. But Mr. Trump claimed he got some GPS things and he measured his title to a very high state of positional accuracy. It worked out that the back of his garage should be here, loophole here. So it was 75 centimetres away from where it should be. And this was the basis of which Mr. Trump said that David Milne had stolen his land and he was taking him to court. And what's interesting about Mr. Forbes' title, Mr. Milne's title, this is on the land register, he's got a very good title. And it references the fact that this boundary follows a fence. And his boundary does indeed follow the fence. And the thing is, in Aberdeenshire, in 1989, or wherever this register was compiled, the positional accuracy of the Ordnance Survey was 1, 2, 3 metres. In other words, what Mr. Trump's done is gone around with a state-of-the-art surveying equipment and said that the fence should be 75 centimetres further in. That's irrelevant, of course, to Mr. Milne and title disputes, because, of course, the boundary is the fence, and whether the fence is plotted in the right place or not is completely irrelevant to questions of ownership. But that's why land registration matters and the rules surrounding land registration matters, because hopefully it will prevent this kind of neighbour disputes. But there are issues in the Land Registration Bill which I'm trying to raise, and others, including amongst which are issues to do with beneficial ownership. We can still, we still have a lot of land that's held by companies in Panama and British Virgin Islands, etc., which I think we should make more transparent. It still allows people to go around grabbing land and recording titles to it without people knowing about it, which is not good. So there's a number of current areas of policy around land which I and others are looking at. Succession law is going to be reformed to give children the right to inherit land. At least that's the proposal from the Law Commission, although the landowners are dead against that. Small holdings legislation is being revived by some people. This was legislation passed after the First World War to give returning servicemen plots of land because they'd gone, fought for their country, got wounded, died, came back and found they had no land rights. That's still in the statute book. Increasing moves to try and restore real local government in Scotland at the parish and town council level. We have a land reform act which is not fit for purpose, which needs to be reviewed. It's frankly useless. A land registration bill going through. We need a Common Good Act. Our current Common Good statute is 1491. It's a little bit out of date. And it needs to be modernised because a lot of common good land is being stolen by existing councils. Hamilton, for example, is missing £50 million from its Common Good funds. We need, I think, a Land Restitution Act to allow land that has been stolen to be recovered. And we need to look at land taxes again. Historically, we've always taxed land. That's the normal thing you do tax. And it really only is in the last 120 years, of course, that we've got rid of land taxes. So that's a quick sort of romp through many of the issues covered in the book and covered in the debate about land today, which has really been kind of slumbering, this debate. I mean, the current government in Scotland, the previous one, really have done very little about this. It's interesting to speculate why. But a lot of the action was in the first Parliament, of the Scottish Parliament, where a number of acts were passed on tenement law, the abolition of feudalism, the Land Reform Act, agricultural holdings. A lot of stuff was passed, which is very beneficial. But nothing's really happened since. So this is a topic which a lot of people care passionately about, but which isn't really taken very seriously by mainstream politicians. So I'll leave it there and look forward to questions, discussions. Sorry, there's been a bit of a kind of romp through a lot of stuff, but we'll just give some food for thought.
Okay, thank you very much. Young folks in this room
a significant percentage, 50%, 60% do you think?
No, because about 12% of Scotland is held by public bodies. So if you've got 20% mapped here, which is mainly in private ownership, there's very little public land there. You added 12, that's 32. So, yeah. In fact, one of the purposes of the new land registration bill is to try and speed up the process of land registration. Because at the moment, the only way land gets onto the register is if it is sold. So, for example, 55% of titles are on the land register. 5% of titles. And that reflects the fact that in terms of the numbers of titles, about 3.5 million titles in Scotland, the vast bulk of them are houses and land in the cities, which is turning over every sort of 5, 10, 15 years. So in terms of titles, we're at 55%, over halfway. But in terms of land coverage, we're nowhere near that, because a lot of these big rural areas are covered by farms and estates, which, I mean, for example, the Clue Estates Limited, which is the biggest private landowner in Scotland, with 250,000 acres, it's owned by Buccleuch Estates Limited. Buccleuch Estates Limited doesn't die. It was set up in 1920, and you can have 20 generations of Buccleuchs. Buccleuch Estates Limited never changes hands. It's always owned by, so it doesn't trigger entry to the land register. So things like that have to be improved to get this coverage up. And it's a major deficiency in our land records that we don't have a modern cadastral survey of ownership, because it means that it's very, very difficult. I mean, if you want to build a pipeline, as people in the past have, you know, from St. Fergus to Grangemouth, whatever. It's a monumental task to locate and identify all the landowners. My sister lives in Switzerland, and her father-in-law works at the local municipality and looks after the land records. And you can just walk into the municipality in Verbier and pull out these drawers and the maps, and people are coming all the time, and you can find out who owns every square inch of the municipality. Because people need to know. They want a new power line in, they want a new pipeline, they want some new drains, they want to put a new ski lift, they want to whatever. They need to know this kind of information. In Scotland, it's very, very difficult, and there's a gatekeeper, which is the Register of Scotland. I mean, it's not even possible to go onto the Register of Scotland as a member of the public and find out this information. You've got to register for an account, and then you've got to learn how to use the system. A land register in England is much, much better. You just go onto their website, type in a postcode, up they come, click what you want, go to a shop, pay with your credit card, and it's there. Of course, their coverage is worse than ours, but yes. Sorry, do you want to handle it? Yes, it's about 3 million titles.
How do they know if they're not registered?
Because they're in the Register of Zazines, the one set up in 1617.
But it doesn't identify what the acceptable land is.
No, but each individual property has its own search sheet. So in the county of Roxburgh, for example, when they started the Register of Zazines, well, there's a modern, but it's gone through various phases in 1880, whatever, they called it number one, and then number two, and number three. So they know in Roxburgh that there are 40,000 titles, approximately. And they know that on the land register, they're only up to number 1,200 or something.
But they don't know what's in the ones that
have. Oh, no, they haven't a clue. No.
A question here.
Thanks for talking. I just want to go back to one of the slides you showed at the start, where you showed about the extent of Scotland's offshore land. Mm. I guess this is quite interesting because it kind of challenges the debate we're having at the moment about the referendum of independence. So I just want, because obviously what is Scotland's offshore land would be very important. I just wonder if you could talk to us about who owns it and maybe talk about the North Sea aspect of it as well.
Yeah.
Where do you find it at the moment?
Sorry to insult your
head positive.
I think. Yeah, I mean, basically, in the white here, Scotland's inland waters, and these are areas within which we have exclusive jurisdiction. From there out to the yellow, these are the continental shelf, the territory of the sea, where we don't have exclusive jurisdiction. These are international waters, but the Crown basically owns the seabed. The only thing the Crown doesn't control is hydrocarbons, and they're nationalised. So all the oil and gas, for example, is subject to the whatever Energy Act of 1979 or whatever. So the Department of Energy control control of all the hydrocarbons. But for example, with offshore wind energy, which is you know, a big thing, and tidal and all the rest of it, it's the Crown Estate Commissioners who administer Scotland's Crown Estate, and they grant the leases that you're required to rent the seabed. And the debate really there is about, you know, the fact that we don't control the Crown Estate Commissioners, they're accountable to the Chancellor of the Exchequer in London. And therefore, although the Scottish Government controls all the, you know, under the Marine Act, controls planning, for example, in the marine areas, strategic planning, it has no control over the actual resource and how it's used. And also people, you know, small fish farmers and people with ports and harbours, they get pretty pissed off as well, because any time they want to extend a breakwater, they have to haggle with the Crown Estate Commissioners, who demand quite a lot of money from them. So it's a kind of monopoly control, this land, which is not being managed in a way that's accountable to the Scottish Parliament. That's at the heart of the debate just now about, you know, who controls it. So, for example, I mean, it's public land. It doesn't belong to the Queen. That's just nonsense. It belongs to the Crown, which is completely different from the Queen. Yeah. It belongs to the Crown. And so it's a public land. So, for example, the Forestry Commission owns nothing, of course. It owns no land. Well, it owns some vans and chainsaws, I guess. But all the Forestry Commission land is owned by Scottish ministers. Obviously, the Forestry Commission is accountable to the Parliament. So we can have a kind of coherent approach to the management of Scotland's National Forest Estate, but we cannot have a coherent approach to management of Scotland's Marine Estate, because we have no control over the rights themselves.
Question, I'm just going to interject, actually. You might be in a position to clarify something that is doing the rounds in the web sphere. There's a cause going about a 1999 order where they changed the sea boundaries from Berwick to Carnoustie.
Yes. That's this line here.
Yeah.
Yeah, the 1999 border, just as the Scottish Parliament took up its powers, and the border used to head off from Berwick, sort of in a straight line, really. And then you moved up here, takes in some of the oil fields here. And I'm not quite sure why they did it. So this comes under English jurisdiction, and this comes under Scottish jurisdiction. So if you commit a crime out here, you'll get prosecuted by the sheriff in Dunbar or wherever, and prosecuted under Scottish law. If you commit a crime here, you'll be indicted by a magistrate in Berwick. And that's caused a lot of nationalists don't like that, because they say it's a big land grab by England. Of course, the UK is a unitary state, was a union state, really. But as such, this is not an international border, and therefore the Westminster government can do what it likes with this border, frankly. But if Scotland becomes independent, votes for independence, then this border will be subject to international rules governing the demarcation of maritime borders. And there are a number of well-established rules for that. And it's almost certain that line would come back south in that event. The rest of these lines, fairly, there's not much you can fill around here. That's well defined by existing international law. Rockall, of course, that's the big, we claim all this on the basis that we claim Rockall. And of course, Rockall's just a land grab by the UK. It's still not established in international law. Who's got sovereignty over Rockall? Ireland claim it, Denmark claim it on the basis of failures, Iceland's registered a claim. But of course, you know, the Russians, I mean, they went undersea under the Arctic with a submarine planted a titanium flag and a long... I mean, everyone's at it. Interestingly, the Loch Foyle in Northern Ireland, between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, Ireland got its independence in 1920, and the UK and Ireland have still not agreed about the marine border on Loch Foyle. It's 80 years it's taken, and it's still 90 years, still not agreed it. And that's causing big problems there, because it means they can't have any renewables or anything in Loch Foyle. Lots of proposals for it, but the UK and Ireland can't agree where the boundary is.
Do you think freedom to roam legislation will be seen to be yet another land grab? I'm talking here in the Esk Valley. The result of that has been landowners have made it more difficult to get access. They by either charging or challenging the local councils to go to court.
In the Esk?
Southeast of Edinburgh.
I think the access legislation, which is part one of the Land Reform Act, was very enlightened and well drafted, well framed. And
this perverse effect of people who are frightened of more access have actually...
Well, yes, but I think one has to balance that against the fact that previously the statutory rights were ill-defined, and therefore we probably lost more as a consequence of that, because we had no defence and statutory defence against land and people taking access. Whereas now we have statutory rights, and there's a process of adjudication where that's under dispute, and none of that was there before. So I think the situation we're in now is a better place than where we were. That's my view. Even though, and the reason it has led to litigation is precisely because the public's rights are now better framed and more entrenched, and of course landowners, therefore, if they want to assert their rights, have to pop up, put their hand up and say something. So we notice these disputes now, but at least they've been resolved according to a fairly clear set of rules.
I'll give you the opportunity to give your comments on the Arden survey. You've mentioned the Register for Scotland, who are of course based in Edinburgh, love them or loathe them, and accountable to Scottish ministers. The topographic survey of Scotland is the responsibility of the Arden survey, which is responsible to the UK Parliament and is based in Southampton. Couldn't get further away from Edinburgh. There is a lot of controversy because they regard at least two-thirds of Scotland as being uneconomic to resurvey. So we're actually dealing with maps that were made in the 19th century. Do you have a comment on that? Do you think that's a reasonable approach? Do you think that the Scottish Government should take up responsibility for surveying Scotland?
I don't really know. We should have a proper topographical map that is uniformly to a certain defined standard, and that is to that standard with a currency which is common over the whole country. If that means that the Scottish Parliament is to take on these powers, then I would support that. Because, of course, the Ordnance Survey is driven by economic considerations to do with land that is valuable, and therefore land that's being developed will be land that they will survey more often, whatever, and certainly they'll neglect a lot of land in Scotland. And that is causing problems. And it does mean, actually, that a lot of people haven't done their own surveys when they want to develop wind farms or sell their land. The new Land Registration Bill, interestingly enough, provides the keeper with powers to not use the Ordnance Survey base if she doesn't want to. Previously she had to. I think we should be responsible for our own maps. If they're that out of date, I wasn't aware that they were that out of date somewhere.
Should we be concerned about the Scottish Government's intervention with regard to Trump's golf course, and what does that tell us about the Scottish Government's or the SNP's approach to Scottish landmarks?
I did a big report on Donald Trump called Donald Trump's Ego Trip, Lessons for New Scotland, which you can get on my website. I think it's a very, very interesting tale, not all been told yet. I was abroad at the time it all happened. I think it's a sordid tale. I know personally some of the Aberdeenshire councillors who were subject to a lot of bullying by colleagues. There were people in tears. This is a guy who basically, the day after he was turned down, said, "Well, I'm off to Ireland if you don't change your mind in 30 days. So he put the system under a lot of stress. I'm not sure that everything was done was totally above board. Although by the nature of these things, telephone calls that were never recorded, meetings that were never minuted, it's hard to know what went on. But clearly, I don't think Trump is going to go ahead. I always felt this was just a big ego trip. If you look at some of the interviews he's done, he claims that he got, as he says, I got this land zoned because of who I am. If I was Lena Lewis, I wouldn't have got it zoned. Well, no, that's not how planning works, actually. It doesn't matter if you're Mary Teresa of Calcutta or Hitler. It's the land that's given consent, regardless of its owner. So he suffers these delusions. He thought when he bought it, he never saw the land. And so when he came and offered money to people like Michael Forbes, who didn't know to buy the property, he genuinely thought all he had to do was just up it until he accepted it. He couldn't still can't get his head around the fact that some people don't want to sell their land to him. And I think it's all coming to a head now because of the offshore wind project that's planned, where he's saying he's going up sticks and leave if that's his head. And that's just another example of the kind of bullying tactics. And I'm certain the Scottish Government will consent to that development. I can't see them refusing it. And so we'll probably see the back of it. But I think we've still got a lot to learn about. I mean, one of the worst things about it is that the planning system works on the basis that if I'm the planning authority, I give consent to this piece of land to develop, a hotel or a factory. And if you're the owner, you have consent for 5 years. After 5 years, if you've done nothing with it, the consent lapses, you can apply again. If after 2 years you depart the country and sell it to anybody else, they can, of course, take forward that consent. And in an urban area, that would happen. If the place got consent for a hotel, the owner changes, someone else will come in, because land in urban areas is, people want to use it. It may lie idle for a number of 2-3 years. But in Trump's case, it's interesting, because he was told he had to build the golf course first, because there was a suspicion that all he wanted was the houses, and the golf course was a fast the other way round. Couldn't really care less about house and hotel. So the golf course he's passionate about. But now he's saying whole projects are hold, because of the economic climate. And now he's saying he's going to walk away if these wind farms go ahead. So the point was, the planning consent was given to him because of the economic benefits outweighed the environmental impact. The economic benefits derived from the houses and hotels and the timeshares. So we might get to a situation where we don't have the very thing that we said justified the destruction of the SSSI. And that, to my mind, renders the planning system pretty... there's something wrong there.
Bob over here, and then we'll back Bob.
A very interesting talk. You've opened up lots of possible questions. I'm still kind of vaguely wondering if that's policy implications and legislation and how things, where we should go from here in an area that I actually don't know that much about, which is really very fundamental. Do you have any suggestions about legislation that is needed?
I presented a series of proposals at the end there, all of which would be useful in my view, very few of which the politicians seem to be interested in just now. And I think we've got a legacy here where, because land's been controlled by a tiny elite for a long time, and they have sat in the legislature. I mean, when I was first getting involved in land issues in the 80s and stuff like that, progressive bits of legislation would never get anywhere near the House of Lords, because the House of Lords would just block them, because, the Earl of Duke of Buccleuch, the Earl of Perth, the Duke of Montrose, they all turned up and vetoed the whole lot. And, Scottish secretaries didn't want to put forward legislation that was just going to get lost in the Lords when they could do something more useful. So a lot of things like feudal abolition, England abolished feudalism in 1298. It took us another 800 years to get around to it. It's just, that's been a big, and the fact that the sort of power over land has come with institutional and legislative power in the House of Lords has been the big block. The fact that we haven't had, inheritance law reform, and that's why Norway and France have got much better, because children have got legal rights to inherit land. We only abolished primogeniture in 1968. So, and I think what the problem with Scottish governments and UK governments just now is they don't have a proper handle on landed power and the significance of land in the economy. I mean, look at George Osborne. And they're not willing to tackle landed power. I mean, if you look at people like, you know, current Agricultural Minister Richard Lochhead, he's basically gone native. He wrote a tweet recently when he went off to Brussels saying, I'm off to, off to Brussels to represent the interests of Scotland's farmers and fishermen. I thought, no, you're not. That's what the NFU, the National Farmers Union, the Scottish Fishermen's Federation, do. You're off to Brussels to represent the public interest in those areas. So it's very easy for politicians to get captured by these elite interests, and they have. And we don't have a national land use policy. I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, some of, you know, the world's leading experts are Scottish, and they're working overseas to develop national land policies for Iraq. We don't even have a national land policy. You look at Scotland's national land use strategy, it doesn't even mention ownership. You know, how can you have a land use strategy that doesn't address questions of control? So I think there's, you know, I'm not confident at all that anything's going to change, frankly. I mean, even with independence, because, you know, 99% of the powers over land exist in the Scottish Parliament. We could do all these things today if we wanted to. There's nothing that we cannot do on land if the political will was there. We can't renegotiate the Treaty of Rome. That's about the only thing we can do. So the idea that we're going to tackle all these things, I mean, maybe we will. But the point is there are vested interests around who have historically blocked this, who have captured the political process. I mean, the land registration is fascinating. I mean, the only people that really were consulted in the land registration were the conveyancing lawyers and the council of mortgage lenders. You have a tiny little elite of kind of lawyers and commercial interest. In fact, the government didn't even publish a press release saying we're publishing this bill. And they talk about its importance for the economy of Scotland and securing property rights. They say nothing about a national land information system and how it can contribute to that. So yeah, I'm not really very optimistic, frankly. But there's a lot we could do, but what needs to happen is that political parties need to have the political will to address some of these questions, and currently, frankly, we don't.
How much do you think has been achieved by the community land act?
Very little. I think if you just repeal it, it's been a waste of time.
Okay, Carol, Andy, I think you're being unduly pessimistic there, because you showed these wonderful pictures of the villagers of Aylith cutting barbed wire and all that sort of stuff.
Yes.
And I think that what you need to do, what we need to do, is increase the knowledge of
absolutely.
This. So, for example, you're talking about Trump and his golf course and about this speculative development, which had to be done for everything else, which has screwed up a major nature conservation site in the northeast of Scotland. I am reminded of all the oil development and all the planning and pressure that was on Scotland during the 70s and the early 80s for oil development in the Cromarty Firth that has screwed up endless miles of mudflats for oil development that never actually happened, because they had to do the development first and then get the investment, and the investment never happened. Therefore, surely we as a society can start to rise up again about this sort of thing and say, well, actually, sorry, it's not acceptable that you're going to do the development first and then put the development in, because by then it's too late. You know, you've destroyed the sand dunes. It doesn't matter whether you build the houses or not. The fact is you've destroyed the sand dunes. So it seems to me that we've got to learn from history, and everything you've said today is about learning from history. But we've got to move this forward and say, unless you learn from the history and you know, understand what's happened, and then do it again by protest or by legislative challenge or by, you know, just going to your council and say no or whatever, you know, it seems to me we will forget the lessons of history.
Yeah.
Why your book's so important, I think.
Yeah, no, I do have optimistic times, and I think that people will rise up and reclaim the land. And yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think one of the problems is that we live in an age of great ignorance about many of these things. And even, I mean, there was issues in Parliament 8 years ago about a company called the Greenbelt Company who were buying up the common areas of housing developments. And the homeowners were all up in arms because they were charging them hundreds and hundreds of pounds. And you think, well, but you bought this. You know, your title, you knew this was happening. And of course they didn't. They looked at their title deeds. You know, they left it to their lawyer. And so that's the problem, I think. Everyone has just kind of left this thing to the lawyers and to the powers that be. And we've slowly forgotten about things like common land, etc. I mean, so even when I went for a meeting with Fergus Ewing, the minister, he asked me in. He actually said, one of his officials said, that we don't believe there is such a thing as common land. And I said, well, that's very interesting. How do you know that? He said, well, we have advice. He said, if you're willing to, you know, make a legal case contrary to that, I'd be happy to hear it. And, you know, I'm not going to, you know, go away and squirrel away. You know, I said, can I see, well, at least let me see your legal advice. No, government's legal advice is not available to the public. And so, you've just got the whole of the... Yeah, that's the pessimistic side. But on the positive side, yes, there are. There's lots and lots of people who care deeply and passionate about this. And there are, you know, there's movements afoot in Aberdeen and in Dundee and in Inverness. There's lots of people talking about, you know, common good land and reclaiming that and understanding it better and kind of studying title deeds and looking at history. So I'm actually very optimistic in many ways. But it does rely on citizens taking this issue up and working at it locally and challenging some of the... you know, the myths and the sort of half-truths that are told. Yeah.
Yeah, I just wondered how you would find out information about common land then, if it's not by definition registered. I should confess I'm a lawyer, but,
yeah.
You know, if you're looking at title sheets, etc., if it doesn't appear, then how do you find out?
Well, exactly. I mean, that little piece of yellow thing, which we're in the final stages of trying to kind of nail down, arose because I just tripped over it in a land registry title, where somebody owned, if you remember, there was a bit of blue, but they had rights of pastures over the yellow, and they had actually mapped that. So I thought, right, look a bit more closely. And so you just kind of look at the history of the title deeds, and you see references to the common. And that's, so it isn't. And then you see the statistical account of 1840 that says there's 86 acres of common. So you have to dig around at estate records and things and look at references to this stuff. It's not that easy, no.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it is. I mean, in England, they've now got a very, very good system of Commons Registration, 2006 Act, and you can go onto the Department of Food and Rural Affairs website. You can actually download a list of all registered commons in the whole of England and Wales, and they're all mapped. And if you want to register a village green or anything like that, you just phone up your council Commons Registration officer, go for it. In Scotland, the minister denies it even exists. So, yeah. But you have to dig and do research. Yeah.
I think we got time for one
whatever, more. Yeah.
How are you doing?
Fine.
One here.
So, I know you're quite involved with the 1,000 Huts campaign, and I wonder if you saw there was any promise in that, because it's a direct action, not a public land, in terms of getting on the land and things like that, to kind of highlight these issues.
It's a question about the 1,000 Huts campaign, which is a kind of campaign. I'm not going to be involved in it now, but down to resurrect the idea of a hutting culture, which is common in France, and Germany, Scandinavian countries where people have hutas, dachas in Russia. In fact, in Germany, it was set up by Hitler, and he was a champion of the people. Obviously, that's what got him to power. And you know, one of the laws he passed was to allow people to set up summer houses in the countryside around the big towns. And so in Germany, if you live in Munich and you're a factory worker, you will have a little summer cabin in basically a glorified allotment. But you're allowed to stay there between May and September. So, I mean, whole families can go there and spend the summer gardening and having fun and all the rest of it. And it's very common across Europe. In Scotland, it was big in the interwar years when landowners around Glasgow and Edinburgh and places felt a kind of a duty to a generation who'd fought and died for the country. But we're living in pretty grim conditions in industrial central Scotland, and gave them bits of land to build huts. But then the Planning Act came in 1947, and that stymied the whole damn thing. Prior to that, landowners could do what they liked with their land. Once the Planning Act came in, you had to apply for planning consent, and it got just increasingly difficult to get permission to build a hut. So we don't have that culture. But I think it would do a lot to revitalise links between town and country. I think it would do a lot to empower citizens to deal with issues of kind of poverty and all the rest of it, if people had the chance to get hold of a bit of land, even in the city. I mean, there's a huge demand for allotments, for example, which is completely unsatisfied. And I think we do need to get back to direct action over some of this stuff, seize the land. That's how they got the small holdings legislation in the early part of the 20th century, is they had land raids. and they seized land and they worked it, and the government had to respond. And I think now that, you know, young people can't get land to build a house, I think it's getting to the stage where we do need a lot more direct action on land.
One more, I was going to leave
the bombshell. On the whole question of the registration of land, it's obviously very frustrating that we've got legislation, we've only got 20% registered. Presumably, you were trying for a law that would oblige full registration, and I just wondered what the politics were that we've ended up with this thing about you only get registered when the land is sold. Why is it doing something?
Well, it was a 1979 Act, which was 30 sections long, and it's the shortest land registration statute in the world. And it was only passed because the devolution bill failed in 79 and had a little slot, so they banked this in. And it was hurriedly thought through, and I think the idea was that, well, nobody had any idea how fast land transacted, because government doesn't collect any statistics. And I think people were under the illusion that land, well, probably changes hands every 20, 25 years. So 1979, by the end of the century, most of Scotland will be on the land register. I'm sure, because they just don't know. As it happens, you know, here we are in 2011, 30 years later, and we've still got 20% on and only 5% of title. So there's no political resistance, really, to the bill as it is at the moment, which aims to, like, speed up the land register by inducing, for example, if you inherit land, that will incur will be a trigger. The keeper can induce registrations.
Couldn't you just do a
census? Yeah, you could do what Lloyd George and the Inland Revenue did in 1910 and just go out there with a lot of people with kind of crowdsourcing and smartphones and things and just map the whole country. I mean, they did it in 4 years, the commissioners of the Inland Revenue, and they produced these maps that are sitting in the National Archives today. Interestingly enough, the staff at the Register of Scotland, when I talked to them about it, didn't even know existed. And that's the extent of our lack of knowledge, is that, you know, our Registers of Scotland don't even know of the one of the most remarkable cadastral maps ever produced in all of Europe. And again, this is back to the question that land is seen as something that's private and not public business. So when the Coolin debacle came up, you know, people like Jim Wallace stood up in Parliament and said, this is a matter for the courts to sort out. There's no public interest in this. And you think, well, yes, there's a public interest in this because the law is an ass. And the law has legitimised theft.
I think maybe we should leave it there. We can maybe retire, maybe ask Andy some questions informally. The number of topics I could have asked on things about the fragmentation of estates and landowners' arguments about the sustainability viability of estates if they're forced to spread them amongst their heirs. SNP in action, Donald Dewar saying one thing and doing another perhaps. It's a bit in your book about that. And of course the state of the Edinburgh Common Good Fund. But I'll leave all of those up to you. The hostelry, which is the TV at the Library Bar. So if you'd like to join us there, retire, but do stay to finish off the refreshments in the back there.
I have some books for sale as well.
And of course, yes, I was going to say, will you be signing those as well?
Yes.